Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and joining me now is David Denby, film critic for The New Yorker. His collection of essays is out now. It's called Do the Movies Have a Future? And David Denby is here in the studio to flesh out that question and give us some of his answers. Hi, Dave. Welcome back.
Hi. Nice to see you.
You used the Iron Man franchise as an example of the dominant trend in movie making. And for those who need a reminder of what that sounds like, here's a snippet.
All I have to do is sit here and watch as the world will consume you.
I am Iron Man. The suit and I are one.
Contrary to popular belief, I know exactly what I'm doing.
Yeesh. So to quote your introduction, the movie success did not depend on word of mouth. It depended on a calculated strategy put into place way before the movie came out. Take us through that calculated strategy. What do you mean?
Well, the whole much of the big studio product is based on comic books or games or increasingly young adult fictions. At least the girls are getting into the game now with Hunger Games, and they catch these kids when they're 7 or 8 or 9, and then they hold them with franchises for another 15 years or so. And my problem with it is, I mean, some of these movies are fun, and Robert Downey has a kind of self-deprecating, ironizing streak that makes a kind of bond with the audience so you don't feel like such a fool for watching him. Hmm. But a lot of it, Brian, is just, you know, contention among exacerbated pixels in a kind of dead air of digital space. And the next day, you don't remember anything. Not a single image. I think David Thompson, the film historian, said that Humphrey Bogart lighting a cigarette has more emotional resonance, you know, more powerful for the audience than any of these enormous movies.
And Humphrey Bogart movies were big hits back in their day. Yeah. So how do you account for empty calories action films, which is, I guess, what you're describing, you know, or Hollywood feeling that they're the only thing they can make to really sell tickets?
Well, it's not the only thing they make. They make all sorts of genre movies with assured audiences, and they make animation, some of which, of course, is very good. But it's because the conglomerates took over the studios. They always loved money. It's a big money game. To say anything else is naive. But the conglomerates, you know, have to make quarterly reports to stock analysts on revenue flow, so that their game is to play for enormous investments that will yield enormous profits. And that means the movies have defoliated the big ones of local flavor, of psychology, of wit, of the things that drew people to the movies in many cases years earlier. And what I'm afraid of is that they've tied their future, the studios, to the birth rate. That is, they're not creating a grown-up audience for movies. They're just waiting for the next group of kids to hit 7, 8, 9, 10 so that they can hold them again with another franchise. It's a self-destructive strategy. And, I mean, there are ways out of this box. Way number one would be to play for small winners. I mean, there's a genre movie out now called End of Watch with Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Pena, a cop movie that costs $7 million, not $150 or $200. It's going to do very well. You could make a whole slate of those every year and make a lot of money. The other way out is to do what Steven Soderbergh, the writer-director, has been saying for years. Don't pay actors their quote, as it's called, their $12 or $14 million, the stars, up front. Pay everybody in Hollywood terms a minimal amount of money, like the star gets $1 million and the director gets $750,000 and the cameraman gets $400,000, like that, up front. Bring costs, initial costs, way down. Then divide the revenue stream from all sources, including the ancillary markets, everything at the back end according to fixed percentages. So, of course, the people who put up the money would get the lion's share, 50%, and everybody else would divvy up the rest in perpetuity. By bringing down initial costs by 30, 40%, it might allow studio people to make much more interesting choices and think of the whole thing differently.
That's a tough sell to get everybody, including the big star actors,
well,
to take a lot less money.
Some will do it. Clooney has done it with Soderbergh on several. And unfortunately, those movies were not hits. If they had been, the model would make a lot more sense. I think Brad Pitt would do it. I think young Channing Tatum would do it. they're getting tired of the roles that they're being offered. They want to develop as actors, and half of them, if they don't get them, they're going to drift off to television, which makes perfect sense.
Indeed, and some of the best movies are being made on television now, right?
Yes, I don't blame the audience for staying home. But look, people who are 40, 50, 60, 70s, I mean, they're vigorous people who like to go out to the movies. They grew up loving movies. They like that, and I'm a religious romantic, you know, about that experience in the dark of meeting 500 strangers, being in the dark. You come out of it. You've had some sort of emotional, uplifting experience. It's not the same thing at home. You're dominated by the screen. You're submerged in it rather than dominating a little device.
I thought the studio profit system included a tranche, to use a Wall Street word, into the smaller or, you know, more indie kinds of films. Like, you know, if there's a huge profit coming in from Iron Man, some of that goes into their pockets and some of that goes into being able to make, you know, some good smaller money movie. There Will Be Blood, I don't know, something like that.
My spies tell me that happens very rarely, that mainly it goes into the next, you know, it would be blockbuster, that the money for the kind of movies you're talking about, There Will Be Blood, is raised from medium-sized production companies, and they get helped by funding sources overseas, from Spain, even when it had money, from France and Germany, from Abu Dhabi. I mean, Louis B. Mayer is turning over in his grave. And it's catch as catch can. Brian, each one is improvised. There's no business structure that supports that. So even if you have a big hit, you're starting all over again the next time, money from 18 sources.
In fact, we saw that There Will Be Blood, which came out in 2007, grossed over $40 million, and Daniel Day-Lewis won for Best Actor, was nominated for Best Picture, arguably one of the best movies of the decade, and yet it took Paul Thomas Anderson 5 years to get together the funding to make another movie, The Master, which is out now.
Right. And Bennett Miller, after Capote, had, I think, a six-year wait. And Alexander Payne, after Sideways, had also a 5 or 6 year. I mean, we get the point, right? Some of the most talented people are not working very much. The old system, which loved money just as much as this one, kept John Ford and William Wyler and Howard Hawks making two movies a year, every year. So, I mean, it's a wasteful system. And they're not laying the ground for grown-up taste. When I was growing up, I'm a little older than you, but when you were a kid, if you were 10 or 11, your parents took you to the movies. You half understood what was going on. You half didn't understand what was going on. You had a lot of questions. What were these complicated sexual arrangements? You know, what are these tormented characters? And then that, trying to figure it out, sort of laid the groundwork for grown-up taste in movies. It may have even, you know, helped you grow up a little bit.
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
sure.
You weren't expected to remain in a state of goofy euphoria, you know, looking at the same movie over again until you were 30.
By the way, what did you think of The Master?
I thought The Master was fascinating scene by scene and extraordinarily acted, but it got very repetitive and didn't – I hate to reverse myself, but it actually needed more of a Hollywood story arc. It needed more resolution, I thought.
And I'll point out that you loved a film that some of us might put into the same category as Iron Man, Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Well, because
– they are contaminated. Put those apes down.
You have no idea what you're dealing with.
Yeesh, again, that sounds like, you know, any number of these, for me, indistinguishable, mindless trailers that I have to sit to before the movie that I went to see.
Well, Rise of the Planet of the Apes was actually very touching because a family raises an enhanced ape, there's this emotional transaction back and forth. The ape takes care of John Lithgow, who's beginning to fail. But what I loved was that it didn't have superheroes banging off walls. It brought out the inner apishness of the ape. In other words, it enhanced what was already there rather than creating extra magical powers. So that one really worked. And, of course, Avatar, I thought, was lusciously beautiful, and I had purple dreams for about a week afterwards. And it used the space marvelously.
My guest, and unfortunately we're almost already out of time, is David Denby, the New Yorker film critic. His collection of essays from recent years is just out in book form. And you suggested one of these essays, written in 2001, that the situation might change if, quote, American culture, under pressure of war and disgust for lying corporate and political leaders, should reach a crisis once again. Boy, that could be written any year, couldn't it? But what did you mean by that? I mean, it has a slight tinge of Occupy.
Well, I was thinking of this, that glorious period in the 70s when there was a kind of embitterment over Vietnam and things calmed down. The 60s movies were a little jumpy and zeitgeisty, but then in the 70s we had The Godfather 1 and 2 and Chinatown and Altman's movies and Shampoo. There was a kind of post-war disillusion that prepped the audience for unhappy endings, for complex plots, for overlapping voices. I mean, I'm wondering if, you know, if people have the invention and the guts, it's not as if there's an absence of talent out there. There's as much talent. We mentioned about six directors. There's tons of wonderful actors. The business arrangements don't make sense. That's the problem. And we've got to find a new way of doing it.
Where does this leave you, the critic, especially for a publication like The New Yorker? Are you actually finding a shortage of things to review?
I jump at any life that I can find. It could be Richard Gere's performance in Arbitrage. It could be Woody Allen's recent movie, which I thought was better than most people said. It could be Ridley Scott, the director's craftsmanship in Prometheus. Wherever there's life, you leap at it and celebrate it.
So if your job is to bring to light movies we might not have ever heard of, why spend any column inches on John Carter or Girl with a Dragon Tattoo?
Well, that's a good journalistic question. And 80% of our readers live outside of the tri-state area, and all they have is to see what's at the mall in many cases. If you know, so we can't give up on the big cinema. Also, I like big movies. You know, I keep hoping. I want them. I mean, Argo, Ben Affleck's thriller is fun. But why should the serious things be sequestered into a 12-week season every fall, and then adults just dismissed like downsized workers to wander around, you know, until they find the haven of television the rest of the year.
10 seconds, literally soundbite. Do the awards matter? Because they seem to try to reward films that have some meaning.
Yes, Beasts of the Southern Wild is the insider's choice for the Oscar. At this moment, that movie cost $1.3 million. Mm, it can be done. All it takes is talent.
Do the movies have a future? The new book by New Yorker film critic David Denby. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.